podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
It is the Weekender, Neil Atkinson, joined by Ian Salmon, Mike Kearney, Ali McGovern and Imani Williams with you for the next, or be about an hour or so, I'd have thought, all told. Talking, obviously, about the fixture list. And then we'll have a little bit of chat about the friendlies and the way in which all of that is shaping up. And there's bits and pieces breaking as we're speaking around Liverpool and Thiago and the fact that there might actually be a little something in it somewhere from the Red side. Melissa Reddy's written something very good in The Independent about that. We'll also be joined by Dermot Cole, who writes about La Liga for The Athletic. He'll be talking about Ronnie the Red and what Barcelona will be up to. And also Dave Lynch joined us to talk about journalists within the transfer window, which John Gibbons, I think, has done with Dave. Will be very, very interesting and worth listening to. You can tell I haven't listened to it yet, as I'm not entirely sure whether or not John's done it. But we'll be all right, and we'll all get through the other side together. We will start with fixture chat and talking about getting the other side together. Ian Salmon, 38 games of football are arranged. They will all move. Well, not all of them, but almost all of them will move into different positions, but the order will stay broadly speaking the same. And Liverpool start off, it's similar to previous seasons. It's a tough first 10-11 games, then it gets a little easier, then it gets tougher, then it gets a little easier, and we've done the last two seasons well enough off that basis.
Yeah, I think it's it is. I looked at it before. It looks a hell of a lot more than 38 games all of a sudden. When you see it crammed together, I have written them all down. I've got them here. I've separated them into things that could be problematic, and probably about 25 of them look problematic to me at the moment. And but that doesn't mean I'm concerned in any way, because I know how great we are. But it's a hard start. I mean, out of those first 10 games, there's 6-7 that look quite big, you know, against decent teams. Leeds a home start, I would have put money on that. That is one of those narrative-based things that happens in every season that makes you go, this isn't random, is it? It's the resumption of an age-old rivalry. I know how you feel about Leeds. I'm personally, yeah, I think everybody knows how you feel about Leeds, Neil. Especially Leeds. I'm sure they will have comments. I'm delighted to see them back up because, as I've said a few times, I lived there for a few years. I've got mates who are huge Leeds fans. No, it was great. Honest to God, I had a lovely time. I was delighted to get back. I missed the water. It's weird living in a dip in the middle of England. You miss water altogether. But I'm delighted to see them. Genuinely, you miss the sea. You don't realise.
Honestly, it's going to be my first question to Ali McGovern. How important is living by the coast? But keep going, Ian.
You can't live anywhere that doesn't have a massive body of water next to you. You just
no, it's wrong, isn't it? It's just weird.
It is wrong.
This is necessary. Leeds, I'm delighted. I am delighted they're back up, and I think it's a great start. Chelsea away is beginning to look more and more difficult by the day, as they seem to be ready to buy every player on the planet that they quite fancy. My personal feeling is Abramovich has looked at FFP and gone, doesn't exist anymore, lads, I can start spending again. And then Arsenal home is a toughie. And then we get the derby almost immediately. So it's a cracking start. As football goes, it's great. The fact that we've got a couple of difficult aways in there, three difficult aways, Chelsea, the derby and City, without fans, could be beneficial for us. It's really hard to know. You know, it wasn't beneficial to have an empty Goodison last time out. So it's a start, isn't it? You've got to play everybody twice. It's the old cliche.
Yeah, I've got to play everyone twice, Ali, and it is a start. But one of the things I noticed, just the similarities with previous seasons. Last time out, Liverpool had played all the other acknowledged top six, even if they didn't finish top six. They played all the other sort of acknowledged top six sides, I think I'm right in saying, by about the 11th game. It's pretty similar there with only really Tottenham and Manchester United. Manchester United is twice later on. But then they had the more straightforward fixtures, and you've got to be careful with that in November and December and early January. And that's been the case for the last two seasons, and I think it's interesting and that it's broken that way again, in that Liverpool sort of know the ropes, they know the terrain, they've planned for this before.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting because Ian says, like, every football supporter will look at this and say, that can't be random. And yet, that's because we're just, like, crazy, like, narrative writers in our own heads of, like, you know, we don't want to believe that anything in football is random, and therefore we create a story about it. Frankly, like, Leeds in the opening game, you know, whoever Leeds played in the opening game, there would be a story about it, and that's just because they're a team team that's, you know, played football for a long time at the top level for a long time. Therefore, there's lots of stories to be told. And we're sort of in that bracket as well, in that, like, you know, we're full of history and resonance and whatever. So whilst you say it's pretty similar to the last two seasons, well, yeah, to a certain extent, although that's just because we've been highly competitive over the last two seasons. So, like, our fixtures have really meant something, whereas, you know, perhaps in the past, you know, we didn't obsess about these things quite as much as we're sort of analysing every step at the moment, because, you know, we're just desperate to have... It doesn't feel like, you know... Like, we've won the title and we're desperate to bounce into this one. It's like we came within a point and then we did it, and now this is the third of an important trio. So I think we're all sort of narrative makers in our own heads about the fixtures. Whereas actually, like, I'm pretty sure it's just random. I think the interesting thing is going to be, like, obviously we'll have this weird situation that we had at the end of last season where we'll have no fans. I think you're probably right to say maybe, you know, that, or Ian's right, that maybe that makes some sort of difference to us amongst those hard games at the beginning. I think the really interesting thing is going to be is that we saw clearly some teams, the break and then coming back without fans clearly did them a favour. I mean, arguably Chelsea was one of those. And so that second game of the season looks to be, you know, a challenge for us. How will Klopp respond to that? What is he going to do in terms of fitness and that going into it? We've got two friendlies coming up, which hopefully are going to be significant games, because they need to be, because, you know, we know, all of us who've read the good work of Mel Reddy know how important those pre-season friendlies are. They're not just a great opportunity for us all to play some teams that we quite like and we've heard of. They are actually a crucial part of the training. So will those more significant friendlies help the team lift their game in advance of what does look to be the difficult start of the season? I really hope so.
They get, Mike, I think one of the things to point out here is that they get those big games early. And talking about Chelsea, for instance, and Arsenal, they look as though they're doing a lot more rebuilding than we look like we are. There may well be the addition of Thiago, and we'll have a little chat about that later on. There may well be one more player to come in, but you can, broadly speaking, pick a pretty solid Liverpool 11 and one that you've seen play together before for Arsenal, for Chelsea, for Everton, then not long after. It's worth remembering the transfer window closed on the 5th of October. I think playing sides who are likely to make a fair few changes early will actually be a little bit of an advantage as well. And in that way, yes, you don't necessarily want Chelsea and Arsenal games 2 and 3, but there are positives to it. And one of those is they'll still be trying to work out literally where each other stands and how each other runs.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, look, Chelsea have gone and signed a player that we were linked with for a while, so it's not like Timo Werner is going to surprise us or any of our players or any of the analysts or Klopp or his team. There's no surprises to be had there. He's a fast lad. We can score goals, so we try and defend that. It's not like we've never played
like me, Mike,
in the past. Well, like you, Neil, yeah. Like, I mean, almost half a version of you, to be fair. So, like, there's no surprises in that sort of thing. I think the fact that they'll still be waiting to bed in, I'd almost rather have Chelsea second, anywhere between the first game and, say, the first international break or second international break, rather than February, March, where everyone's bedded in. You know, they've got a rhythm. I'm happy with the fixtures, really. I mean, I know it's a cliche and everyone says it, you've got to play everyone twice, but, you know, there is certain aspects of luck throughout seasons where you'll get a team in a bad run, you'll get a team who's struggling with the manager, or you'll, like, injuries, they all play a part. So they're all the unseens to come for the rest of the season. But for how it looks on the face of it at the moment, I'm fairly happy that, you know, this Liverpool team will go and do what we've seen it do in the past. And, you know, the derby is big for me, because the first time round with no fans, it was after a long break, and okay, they're all fit lads, but they weren't match fit, and Klopp likes to talk about rhythm a lot, and we'll have a bit of rhythm going into that derby. So I'm looking forward to righting them wrong, so to speak, and giving them a good game with no atmosphere of the Everton fans there, because let's be honest, like, they do get up for it, and It is a tough game. We've not won there all that often, although we haven't lost there since 2010. It's one to look forward to, though, definitely.
Definitely. Imani, one of my things on this is is it's sound enough after Champions League group games as well. We hope Liverpool progress into the last 16 and last 8 of the Champions League, but, you know, there's a competitive thing there. But the Champions League group games do have an impact, and Liverpool having Sheffield United at home, West Ham at home, Brighton away, Wolves, Fulham away. Wolves at home will be tricky, and City away, obviously, but City are in the same boat as us. They're playing Champions League football that week prior to that. They couldn't have broken much nicer, I don't think. There's not, for instance, a really tricky, horrible, sticky away in there like a Southampton or a Wolves. Yes, you've got to play Wolves at home, but I like the way that's broken for the Reds.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. And, you know, sometimes it's tough because obviously, Champions League fixtures are huge. Fixtures are huge focal points for players. It's what players dream about playing their whole lives. And I always am wary of those games. You think, okay, this should be really manageable. You don't think looking at the fixture list, we should worry about that one. But a lot of times we do end up being a little bit more fatigued after playing a challenging Champions League game. So we'll see how that goes. To be honest with you, it's my biggest concern is fitness. I think we're starting off with that short preseason. We come out swinging and we've got a really tough first 10 games. And I hope that by the time we're getting into November, December, that we are still fit. We've been very, very lucky that our best players for the most part have stayed fit. With Henderson, losing Henderson at the end of the season was a little bit of a wake up call about how delicate things are. I mean, we're stacked in midfield, as we know, with the whole Thiago and Ronaldo and Saga, things like that. But I just hope we can stay fit, and I won't take any game for granted now because with this accelerated timeline, we don't really know what's going to happen. There isn't a real reference for this.
Mike, you mentioned before Everton away and City away. Well, it is unlikely there'll be 100% capacity. We can't say anything for certain at this stage. But the flip side of that is Everton at home and City at home at a time where you would expect there to be a full capacity crowd for Liverpool to play those games. Manchester City, 6th of February, in their big, big red circle around that one in terms of setting up the second half of the season. And again, that's fallen kindly for us. We are talking here about something that is random, but you can point out little areas where it has actually fallen quite kindly for Liverpool, and this is another one.
Yeah, I said before, it could have gone worse for us there, couldn't it? And going into the second half of the season, you would expect us to be in and around the conversation, whether it's ahead of the conversation or just trailing the conversation. I don't think we'll be miles off. I don't think City will be miles off like they were last season gone. I think there'll be a tighter title run. And, teams down further down the league, Chelsea will want to be up and around us, maybe not level, but within striking distance. United are obviously going to want to be up and around the conversation at top four again and as close as they can. So I think we'll see another 90 plus season, and the fact that we can be sort of February is halfway point in it, like 20 games played by then. We've got then a long run in. Hopefully we're still involved in the Champions League. I don't know about the FA Cup. I think that's when it can all start getting a bit more weighted towards the deeper squads. We've seen ourselves, last season how the League Cup was treated, and we all had the best out when Curtis Jones scored the goal of the season against Everton. Hopefully something like that can happen again. But no, I'm. It's a shame. Obviously, for everyone's safety, we had to stay away from the stadiums, and there's other things going on in the world. That means that's fine. We've just got to bide our time with that. But at some point, what's got me excited about this season is the fact that hopefully, whether it's 100% or 50% or somewhere, we'll have fans back in the stadium at some point, which is what we've all wanted and what everyone will be wanting, because we've gone and done the thing that we always wanted. Yeah. And we'll get at some point this season to celebrate that properly.
There's another artificial sort of thing within the season there that Mike's alluded to, Ali, which is that first game, that first bank of games where supporters are back. And that doesn't just happen once. There's the first bank of games where a small number of supporters are back, and then there's the first bank of games where hopefully stadia are full up and down the country, and that will almost feel like a refresh, and no one knows when that is at this stage. You can't plan around that, but I'd expect some pretty crazy results around that period, because I think it'll be a big emotional release for a lot of people.
We don't know when that's going to be or what that will look like. Life is uncertain at the moment, in particular in relation to this virus that we're all dealing with, but you know, it will be a massive emotional release. I was lucky enough in my day job to visit the cricket trials at Edgbaston, and you could see, I mean, let's just say I'm new to the game of cricket, but you could see some of the, like, really... people who really, really love cricket who were around me getting really emotional just at, you know, there was like just quite a few fans watching a county friendly, and they were getting really emotional just hearing that ripple of applause as the players came out. And, you know, just imagine what it's going to feel like when we're able to properly hear an Anfield roar. I mean, I don't think anybody could quite on this call could quite describe how good that's going to feel and how big that's going to be. I can't imagine what it must be like being a player, having got used to running out to silence, and then at a certain point you will run out to this wall of noise again, and to the hope and anticipation of people actually there looking at you, and that's going to be amazing for them. And psychologically, we know, like, football is a game played in the head. To a certain extent, psychologically, that's going to have a massive impact. So in and amongst all of these fixtures is that phenomenon somewhere. And who knows what kind of a crazy kind of impact that could have on, obviously, ourselves, but any of the teams who are competing, or any of the teams who are likely to find themselves at the bottom of the league come Christmas as well. There's going to be some teams in here who are going to need to plan for a kind of relegation escape as well, and their fans returning could play a crucial role at some point, which then that could have a knock-on impact on our season as well. Who knows when it will come? There is a lot that could be part of the story of this season.
Ian, have also broken nicely. Liverpool, I've got Villa at home, Leeds away, Newcastle at home. Then there's a big game against Manchester United on the 1st of May, currently scheduled for. But then after that, again, it goes to Southampton at home, West Brom away, moves through into Liverpool, going to Burnley, where we've got an excellent recent record, and last game of the season at home against Crystal Palace. That's a run-in I would have paid, I'm not going to say a stupid amount of money for, but I would have paid decent money for if you'd have offered me that at 8 o'clock this morning before the fixtures were out.
Oh yeah, I'd have taken it as well. It's what you would pray for, basically. That is, hopefully by then, by 17th of April when the Leeds game comes, we could once again have won the league, because if we attack everything...
Let's keep on. I'm happy to win it in May, mate. I'm happy to win it in May.
Honest to God, I've no desire to keep my head on anything anymore after last year. I imagine we're going to approach the season the way we approached every game. I think this is a logical conclusion. My approach is basically totally in logic here. I think we approach everything the way we did last year. Every game's a must win from day one. I don't know where City stand. I don't know what to expect from City. I think there's a possibility they might be a little bit broken after last week. I would expect Raheem Sterling to be a little hesitant after his mistakes of last week. That's certainly what I hope for. The only tough one there is, and this is where I'm getting ahead of myself again, the United game is smack in the middle of two legs for the Champions League semi-final, where I thoroughly expect to still be. So that's a difficult week. That is going to be a hard week. But, you know... It would be lovely getting a guard of honour at Old Trafford.
Honestly, everyone needs to calm down. No. We're not winning this league in April.
But that run-in's good. That run-in and the Christmas period, the period through the end of November into the beginning of January, they're two things that you would hope for. So the fixtures have broken kindly for us there. So a tough start, but... Two very nice bits to have in the middle and to end with. And also, while we're talking about narrative and randomness, aren't Everton away at Man City on the last day of the season?
They are indeed. Let's all very much... That's very much next May's problem, that one. And we all need to bear that one in mind. Listen, thank you very much indeed for this part of the show to Ali, to Ian, to Mike and Imani. We'll be back in a little while. Before then, you've got Dermot Corrigan and you've got Dave Lynch. Don't go anywhere. It is the Weekender with the Anfield Wrap.
And it is John Gibbons now for the Weekender. I'm delighted to be joined over Skype by Dermot Corrigan, who's... been something very interesting about Barcelona and the way forward there. So first of all, Dermot, welcome to the Anfield Wrap. I think it is the first time.
Yeah. Hey, John. Nice to be here. Good to talk to you guys.
So obviously at the moment, you know, Barcelona is you know, a huge story in European football. Arguably the biggest, and the rebuild job they have to do is seemingly a large one. What your article gets across really well, and the reason I want to speak to you about is, it's basically going to be a lot harder than maybe people think. I mean, we've all had goes of championship manager and things like that, where, you know, you just sell a load of players and get a new ones in and suddenly you're winning games. For a few reasons, but largely a wages one. And that's going to be very difficult for Barcelona over this summer.
Yeah, part of what's happened at Barcelona over the last couple of years is that, you know, we've all seen the amazing team that they had going back to Guardiola and then Luis Enrique as well winning the treble in 2015. But since then, most of the players who were in that 2015 team, Messi obviously, but also Suarez, Rakitic, Busquets, Jordi Alba, Pique, they all signed big contract renewals. So they all got wages, they all got their salaries bumped and got on long-term deals just at the time where they were all kind of entering their 30s and their performances were going down. So their value to the club kind of was going down while the cost to the club was going up in a kind of business sense. And now they've been hit by this, you know, the train crash of the A2, which had been coming, you know, as over the last couple of years, you guys know very well what happened last year against Liverpool in the Champions League and, you know, they'd Roma the previous year. But now they've just been hit by this situation where they'd love to renew the team. They should have renewed it, you know, over the last couple of years, but it was more difficult to move on guys who were so loved as well, guys like Pique and Busquets, who, you know, are such huge figures in the club's history. But come to the point where they need to move them out, or they feel they need to move them out, but who's going to take, you know, Busquets and pay him like more than 10 million euros a year now that he's 32 or 33 and not the player that he was before? And similarly with all the other guys that I mentioned as well, even Luis Suarez, who, you know, is on huge money, it's just 1 year left on his contract and he's had a lot of injury problems, and, you know, who's going to take him as well?
Do you think this is an inevitable result of sustained success? So is this the sort of, you know, the, you know, what any club maybe would have to put up with, you know, to, you know, considering sort of, you know, what they've been through? Or do you think quite obvious mistakes have been made and, you know, and this is actually not a result of sustained success, but actually sort of 2 or 3 years of bad decision making?
Yeah, to an extent, it is always difficult when you have a team of great stars who grow together to move on to the next team. It is very difficult. And also when a lot of them are homegrown or have been with the club for a long time, there can be emotional reasons why it's tough to break it up. Excuse me, having said that, you know, Barca's transfer dealings over the last 5 years or so have been pretty awful. They've spent over 800 million euros on players. Again, you guys would know, like, the money that they spent on Coutinho, other people like Griezmann and Dembele, which hasn't worked out. So they've spent an awful lot of money to try to renew the team. They've known that this was coming. It's not been a huge surprise to them. But, you know, the people who they have signed have not been up to the task. They've not been either good enough on the pitch or not had the personality, because to come into a dressing room full of guys like Busquets, Pique, Messi and impose yourself is not so easy. But that's what you need if you're going to continue to be at the top. And if you're Barcelona, you should be able to attract the best players. You know, there was a time when, again, to go back to the Suarez example, you know, you can get Suarez, or whether it's Fabregas, it was similar to Madrid going for Ronaldo or Bale, that they had the pick of whoever they wanted, really, but they ended up buying guys who they shouldn't have bought, really, who either weren't good enough players or just weren't good enough fits personality-wise or style-wise for the team. So you'd have a little bit of sympathy for them, but because of how they've just mismanaged the situation and misspent so much money, five different sporting directors as well over the last 5 years, all with their own ideas, different presidents as well, different directors at the club, all making transfer decisions. So, you know, they've got themselves into this mess themselves, really.
There's obviously a new manager coming in. Do you think he might be able to get any more out of those signings? Because, you know, we know at Liverpool what a great player Phil Coutinho is. Mm-hmm. And everyone knows what a great player Griezmann is kind of around the world. And so, you know, the signings that necessarily haven't worked out, but ones at the time that I don't think many people were saying, you know, that Barcelona sort of shouldn't be getting, yet maybe some debate over fees. But do you think there's an opportunity for them to sort of resurrect their Barcelona careers under a new manager?
That's the hope. Like Coutinho and Koeman did his press conference, his presentation here on Wednesday, or, well, I'm in Madrid, but over in Barcelona on Wednesday. And he said he was very kind of careful about what he said about Coutinho. He said that he's got a contract and we'll have to see basically was what he said. The feeling with Koeman is that he's a guy who has such huge status at Barcelona for scoring maybe the biggest goal in the club's history to win the 1992 European Cup. And he also has a personality, you know, Everton fans as well might, you know, he believes in what he's doing, whether right or wrong, it's kind of his way is what he's going to do. So he's somebody who can say to, maybe Coutinho can't get into the team because the older guys are blocking him, or even if there's a personality issue there that Coutinho was maybe felt overshadowed or not, people weren't playing to his strengths, that Koeman is a coach who's going to say, okay, this is what I think is the best 11 that I'm going to put out, or this is the best way we're going to play. And if Busquets doesn't like that, or if even Luis Suarez doesn't like that, then that's going to be their problem, not his. Again, that's easier said than done, as we were saying before about the football manager idea. But the hope, I guess, at Barcelona is that Koeman has the CV behind him and the personality to be able to come in and make decisions. Whether it works out for Coutinho or not, I think if somebody offered even Barca, you know, half of what they paid for him, then they'd snap it up tomorrow if a club came in for him. But at the moment, with the market the way it is, that looks pretty unlikely.
Who do the supporters sort of pin the blame on for all this? Because, like you say, you know, some of these players who we're talking about ushering out now are absolute legends, you know, at the club. And so I would imagine that supporters are still a fair way off turning on the likes of Piqué, for example, because of what he's done. But obviously they are on big wages and they are still there and they're not performing at the level. I mean, obviously, you know, it's hard to sometimes say, well, your supporters are a different kind of, you know, all different, I have different kind of thoughts, yeah, and they're not, sure, yeah, you know, one group. But generally speaking, you know, who do the supporters sort of pin the blame on for that sort of catastrophic defeat?
Yeah, just on what you said, there would be a big difference between the guys, the socios who go to the Camp Nou every 2 weeks, and the people who we'd come across on Twitter as to who they blame and what their opinions will be on the players. And I guess that happens at all clubs as well. But the guy who's really getting the blame is the club president, Bartomeu, more than the players. Like, he's kind of a figure of somebody who's just mismanaged it. Also because he's now come in and said, look, I'm going to fix it and I'm going to turf these guys out. Whereas people were going to automatically maybe take Piqué's side or Busquets' side over the club president. You know, what's he done for the club, really? So it's a difficult one for him. He says that he's kind of sacrificing his own reputation in order to do the hard work that needs to be done. But maybe a lot of fans aren't buying that. They're wondering if he has his own reasons, you know, which we don't need to get into here for not leaving immediately. There is even the hardcore Barcelona fans at the Camp Nou would accept that there is a need to change the team. Whether that means that Busquets has to be pushed out, or Jordi Alba, or even Suarez, they're not going to be really angry with Koeman for making the changes if the, you know, better players come in or younger players come in and the team starts to play well. A problem would be if, you know, you've end up, as kind of mentioned in the story that we started off this talking about, you can't get rid of, you know, you've told Busquets that you don't want him anymore, but he's still hanging around. You told Suarez he's still there. Jordi Alba is still there. They're either on the bench or, you know, been put aside. The team aren't doing very well. There's going to be a call to, you know, the midfield was awful last week. Let's get Busquets back in there. Or, you know, who's this guy who's playing at left back now? We need Alba back. That's going to be very difficult for Koeman to manage. And he is a... you know, he knows his own mind and everything, but maybe diplomacy wouldn't have been his biggest strength at Everton as well. No. So how that goes is, you know, we're never a dull moment here in covering La Liga, maybe the same as with yourselves as well, but everybody's kind of looking forward to see how, you know, just going to be fascinating to see how he deals with it. And there's so many different subplots, and I haven't even mentioned that Barca are, you know, they've got a lot of financial problems. They bring in a lot of money, but then that a lot of that has dried up because of all that's happened over the last year or the last months. So the revenues have been hit, but their costs are still the same on their salaries and all. So they have big problems as well. They can't just go out and spend as much as they want on different players. So again, you know, it's super interesting situation to watch, but could be more painful times for Barca fans when they're that invested in the team.
I'm interested in the fact that it was Bayern Munich who knocked them out and sort of gave them this spanking, because I remember we played Bayern last year and we knocked them out, and around that time it was talk of, well, it's an ageing team and things need to change. And I think that looking back was probably a little bit exaggerated in terms of, you know, and I don't think that the problems were as deep as they are at Barcelona now. but it still sort of shows how quickly it can turn around, really. If you know, if you think, as I say, this time last year, you know, Bayern was seen as, you know, they needed to do this big upheaval, and in the end, it was just sort of a bit more youth, a couple of good signings, and a bit more energy, and then suddenly it's revitalised the whole club. Do you think Bayern and what they have done this year can be a bit of a blueprint for Barcelona moving forward?
Yeah, I think that sounds fair, because, you know, people like Robin and Ribéry were legends there, and I guess they had Lama and guys who have moved on as well. But they didn't throw everybody out. They, you know, even the team that beat Barca 8-2 had a couple of guys who've been there for a long time as well, and who are still performing really, really well. You know, a lot depends on the energy of the skills or whatever, the personality of the new guys who come in, and then whether the coach is able to integrate them. Because we saw earlier on this season at Bayern, the same squad, and they didn't seem to be going great at all under Kovac. Then the new coach comes in, who's I don't follow Bayern every week, but he seems to be a more just better on the wavelength of the players, yeah, and able to get everybody coming together and build an idea that we're all in it together. Not that there's the older guys versus the younger guys, or that the new guys versus the old guys. And so in theory, it shouldn't be that difficult to, if you are Barcelona and you had a bit of money to spend and you sign, you know, maybe sign a new left back, a new centre forward, another guy in midfield, and suddenly things work out. I guess at Liverpool, you know, Liverpool's made a couple of really good signings a couple of years ago and turned them from or just made such a big impact on Liverpool's season. So, you know, it can happen at any club. Whether Barca at the moment have the people to make the decisions about the transfers, to make those smart decisions and to be diplomatic about it at the same time, doesn't look like it, but it's possible.
And just finally, Dermot, I've got to ask you about Messi, because there's obviously stories around, you know, contradiction stories, I guess, around, you know, did he might go? I'm sort of not going to ask you to sort of, you know, to nail your colours on the mast too far, but it just seems so, I don't know, like incredulous that the Lionel Messi would play for anyone else. You know, he's just so associated with sort of Barcelona, and the idea of Messi in another shirt, I don't know, it's just a really hard thing to get your head around.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it also is for him himself. Like with the Athletic, we've had a chance to talk to some people who know him quite well for different pieces that we've done over the last couple of months, and even over the last couple of days, just trying to get a feeling for what he thinks, which, because of Messi being Messi, even it can be difficult for those even closest around him to know exactly what he thinks. But he what he really wants is for Barcelona to be playing really well, and for him to be in the captain of the Barcelona team that wins the Champions League. Like that's what he wants way more than to earn more money or to even go to England and win the Premier League. Or, you know, his family are in Barcelona. He's grown up there really since he was very young. His kids are all in school, all those things. He loves the life there. His friends are there. To uproot himself at this stage and move to another club around Europe just seems really, really unlikely. But he's super frustrated, or the feeling that we get is that he's super frustrated with how things have gone, and that he feels that he gets the blame. You know, that the board spend €800 million on these 30 different players and none of them seem to fit. And then the stories come out that, oh, it's because Messi won't pass it to them, or it's because they all have to do whatever Messi says, or Messi's captain, but he never talks to anybody. All these type of stories come out. And he's, that as well as the team not winning, he's already frustrated at that. And then he feels he has to deal with fingers being pointed his way that is not fair. And a couple of the Instagram posts, so he's spoken more over the last 12 months or so than over the rest of his career in total. He's made his views public, and what he has said was that, you know, people should take responsibility. My responsibility is to be the captain of the team, be a good player, score the goals, that type of thing. My responsibility isn't to pick the coach or to decide on the transfer targets to spend the money. That's somebody else's responsibility, and they should take, I'm using the word responsibility a lot here, but they should take responsibility for their own decisions as well, and not try and lump it onto me or onto the dressing room. And since the defeat to Bayern Munich, that's what happened, is that the club president, Bartomeu, has come out and said, you know, these players who are Messi's, some, like Suarez is probably Messi's best friend outside his family, yeah, but he's been signaled as, you know, one of the main people who are to blame for the 8-2, whereas from Messi's point of view and Suarez's point of view, for sure, you know, Bartomeu is the most responsible. He's the chief of the club. So, you know, he's not taking responsibility himself, and that's not going to make Messi happy. But again, I don't think he's going to move. You know, if you still, as you say, it's impossible to see him really playing for another team. But, it's not going to be, you wouldn't rule anything out at Barcelona at the moment after how things have gone over the last couple of weeks or years, you could say.
It's going to be a really interesting summer and beyond. Huge thanks to Dermot for joining us. If you want to read the full article, it is on The Athletic, and I'm sure there'll be lots of other stuff regarding this story over the next couple of months as well. But in the meantime, huge thanks to Dermot Cardigan for joining us, and now back to the main show. And it's still John Gibbonson. I'm joined by David Lynch from the Evening Standard to talk about what it's like being a football journalist during the transfer window. So, Dave, welcome to, welcome to the weekend. You've been on loads, but hiya.
Hello, John. Nice to be back.
You've never done it on Zoom.
No, it's true. It's a bit adding different feel to things.
I know. I miss you coming in and seeing what lovely coat you've got on that day. I don't get that anymore.
You don't get that treat in summer anyway. I'm in the t-shirt today, so it's not the same, is it?
Not the same. David, man of many skills, including a fantastic coat collection. But anyway, what I want to talk to you about, Dave, is obviously you cover Liverpool for the Standard, and I always think transfer windows are an interesting time for journalists because people want answers from you, but if you give them answers and they're not the ones they want, they seem to get very angry indeed.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, when I used to work for the club, I always sort of used to see journalists who are working for external publications sort of, you know, from time to time, they'd moan on Twitter about, the transfer window, I can't stand it. My view then, which was probably quite naive, was thinking, well, to be honest, if I was back working for an external publication, and this was a kid, you know, when I was at the MEN and things like that, I used to think, well, the transfer window is pretty useful. It's, you know, it's a good time for a bit of almost self-promotion. You're breaking stories that people actually want to read and care about. And it, you know, that really cuts through sort of all football fans seem to get, you know, really, really into transfer stuff. So, you know, the opportunity to break those stories should be excited about. So when I worked for Liverpool, I used to think, why are people moaning about it? And then I'm now 2 years into working for the Evening Standard and I'm sort of, yeah, I can sort of see where they were coming from, to be honest, because it's the period where people are seemingly most unhappy with the team, even though, you know, I suppose, especially for me at the moment, because I've been covering Liverpool and they've been pretty much flawless since I've done that for the Evening Standard. So the period where that, you know, people get most riled up has been over transfers, and there hasn't been an awful lot of them recently. And, yeah, so some of the stuff around that really just spills over into, you know, people going too far, getting too angry, and yeah, it's not an enjoyable period, to be honest.
Well, it's interesting to me at the moment because it's the level of anger that people get, and then coupled with the fact that they've decided that no one knows what they're talking about. So at the moment, there's in certain circles a bit of a sort of a Liverpool echo backlash I've noticed, and someone's decided that you can't listen to them. They don't get any information anymore. And so they don't know what they're on about. And I'm like, well, if that's true, then don't worry about what they're writing. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. You can't have it both ways. Yeah. Like, if you think they haven't got a clue, then if they say we're not buying Thiago, then don't worry about it. I always think, like, Paul Gost or whoever writing that we're not buying Thiago doesn't make that transfer less likely to happen.
Yeah, well, this is it. You can't have it both ways. You can't say that you don't believe what they say and then get completely het up about it and so angry online and start tweeting not just the papers' social media feeds, but tweeting the individual journalists telling them they're clueless. You know, from my point of view, if I ever tweet anything about transfers, it's sort of one of the first replies is always someone replying to the mate going, is he reliable? I'm like, I can see you say that. If he says no, I'm going to be gutted about that. You know what I mean? It's like, and I think that's 90% of the interactions around transfers. I wonder if, you know, do people realize that we actually read some of this stuff? Like, I don't read all my interactions and mentions on Twitter, especially if it gets busier when you do tweet about a transfer or whatever. But when I do read it, it's really sort of disheartening. I don't think people have that connect between the idea that there is actually someone behind that who has to read this shit. And, you know, I tweeted the other day about some transfer and there was a bit of back and forth about it. I think it was ruling out a move for Talis Magno, the guy who's in Vasco da Gama, and got a bit of kickback off a couple of people over that. And it really was just the thing of, you don't understand that there's a human being writing this. And that, and ultimately as well, I know a lot of other journalists will maybe be, you know, approach it in a different way. And some of the newspapers do take flyers and they'll write things that they think might be semi-true or whatever to sort of generate. I know that does go on across the industry, but journalists such as myself who sort of, I like to sort of interact with people. I try and have like a bit of a profile as in, you know, I don't sort of hide and just lash stuff into a paper and anonymously almost. The idea that people are coming back to me and sort of saying, you know, you don't know anything, or, you know, this guy's seen this bit of info and he's just taking a guess at it. It's like, well, why would I do that? Because ultimately, every time I write something, I stake my reputation as a journalist on it. Mm. So, you know, you'd like to think that people appreciate there's a bit more thought gone into it just than, oh, I'll get one tip off someone and I'll go with it. Because ultimately, if it's wrong, you're only going to remind me forever. Do you know what I mean? Whereas, yeah, you know, so, but where some people obviously seem to get away with being wrong several times if you write something that people want to happen. So yeah, it's such a mess. It really is first world problems, to be fair. I do appreciate that. I'm going off on something that it really doesn't matter. It's just nonsense on the internet. But when you read it, maybe it's just me. I take it personally sometimes, and I probably shouldn't. Maybe that's my problem, I suppose. But, I wish people would appreciate that there is someone who has to read these things that they say, these mean things.
It's funny as well, because another thing I've noticed that's creeping in a little bit more in the way people sort of, you know, decide that how journalism works is that the good old days 5-10 years ago when Liverpool used to buy someone, used to want to buy someone from the club, with apparently used to ring you up and say, oh, by the way, we're in for Jamal Lewis, say, for example. And now the club have stopped doing that. None of you know what you're on about. That's not exactly how it either used to work or work now, is it?
I think there was an element of, in the past, to be fair, it was a little bit more open, definitely. I think things used to play out in the press a little bit more. But that was also a time at which Liverpool were sort of, you know, not signing Kanoplianka after 4 weeks of trying, or Willian, and, you know, it was all getting played out publicly, and then sort of they were ending up with egg on the face in the end anyway. But, you know, if you were a journalist on the patch at that time, probably a bit of a golden era in terms of getting stories. Now, I missed a lot of that, either through working at the club or being at the Manchester Evening News as I was. It is a bit less open. But that said, all the journalists on the patch have got other sources, other means of getting stories. I like to think that we do get stories. I know, you know, I like to think I've got a few in my time at Evening Standard. So the idea that because it's not being drip-fed to us by the club that we don't know anything is, I just don't think is true. And it's quite offensive, really, just in the, you know, from a professional perspective. If I write a story about, you know, a news story about any other element of the club that's not transfers, people don't sort of think, I don't know, sort of tally the two things of, well, where did you get that from? Especially if you're not, you know, if you're not getting it direct for the club most of the time. So we do all have different sources and different ways of digging up stories. So, you know, I just like people to sort of know that, especially the group of journalists who cover Liverpool, are very professional people who want to be good at the job. They don't ever want to write anything that's wrong. And I think 9 times out of 10 across that patch, that's a good bunch of journalists. I think we tend to get most things right. So, the idea that we know nothing is just, I think, just a little bit unfair, to be honest.
Are you surprised that, like, as a group, we haven't sort of calmed down a little bit more? Like, I always thought, like, when Liverpool won the league, finally did it, we'd all spend all summer in a park singing and dancing and on the beach. So that seems to last about 3 days. And maybe it's because we weren't in the grounds, or maybe it's because, you know, it's felt like an unusual way to win a league title. Or maybe I've just given all of us far too much credit. But, you know, it's not seemed to dampen that we need new players sort of mentality, really, has it?
Do you know what I'm slightly wary of as well, in amongst me moaning about all this, is probably, it's a very certain type of fan that does this. So we you and I are talking about this now, and this is very much a social media phenomenon. I don't ever walk into Anfield and get berated about transfer stories, or, you know, it's someone coming over to me angrily remonstrating with me about these things that we're talking about. It just doesn't happen. And that's not to say that all the fans who don't regularly attend the match are the ones who are crying about transfers, but there's a very, very specific sort of fan, and I think primarily younger in age, which you can see from the language they use online. They've all got a very sort of, you know, it's what they call football Twitter, isn't it? They go by the name of, they've all got, you know, they've all got a footballer avatar. They're all sort of youngish. They've got very sort of similar ways of speaking that they've all picked up off each other. And I think they're the ones who get angrier. And I think, you know, this is probably why I shouldn't read into it too much. I got too bothered about it. Is that I do think a lot of them are younger kids, you know, sort of on summer holidays at the moment. Just, you know, to them, sending an angry tweet to someone about transfer means nothing. Plus, they probably are a little bit more into that side of things at the moment. I think that's something you are a bit more interested in when you're a little bit younger. You know, not to say that transfers aren't important. They definitely are. They're a big part of what Liverpool's journey they've been on under Klopp. But, you know, you may be a little bit less sort of fussed about that sort of thing as you get older as a fan, I think. So I think most of the noise comes from that group of people, that younger set of fans, and then we conflate that with being the entire fan base is absolutely crazed about transfers. And I don't think it is. And I think, you know, even the ones who are into the transfers still, you know, would never speak to someone so rude about it and interact with people in the way they do. So, you know, as much as I don't want to tar everyone with the same brush, to be fair. And I don't want us to say that's across the whole fan base, that there's an unhappiness with being league champions and they still need to sign players. I think it's, yeah, I do think it's that football Twitter group of maybe slightly younger fans who, you know, there's big, you know, you get big credit if your team makes a big signing as well on football Twitter. So I think we can't sort of throw everyone in with that.
Yeah, if you want to be nice to David Lynch on Twitter, he's at Lynch Standard. You know, he's writing great things all the time. Feel free to sort of let him know. Just before we let you go, Dave, obviously the Liverpool season starts again on Saturday. Have you got sort of, you know, any plans to sort of get to any of these games? Presumably you had some of the sort of later ones. Are there any of the press access for these friendlies, do you know?
No, unfortunately not, just because of the conditions they're doing everything in. They're so wary about getting anyone near the players. Obviously, when it's Premier League, Champions League matches, they have to sort of make allowances for press access to that. So, but in the case of friendlies, they can do what they want. So the best thing for them is to not have us anywhere near, which is fair enough. So, yeah, I'll be waiting till the Community Shield, hopefully, to get back to attending Liverpool matches. But I'm very much looking forward to that one.
Yeah. That was something to look forward to. Dave will be watching on LFC TV with the rest of us. Huge thanks to Dave. Hopefully that gave a bit of an insight into what's going on in his life over the summer. And now we'll go back to the main show.
Welcome back. Dermot and Dave were great, weren't they? One other word said against either of them. Moving forward then to talk about the way in which this goes this weekend. There's the friendly games building up for Liverpool. It's crazy to think that next weekend's weekender builds up to the Community Shield. Who would have thought such a thing would be possible? But it is true. So therefore there are two pre-season friendlies coming for the Reds. And the aim of the training camp, Mike, is to get the players fit and back familiar in the shapes that Liverpool play. And I don't think that there'll be any massive sea change from Jurgen Klopp, but we may see a few more, a little bit more variance on the formations. The other thing as well, though, is obviously to get the players who haven't been around, whether or not because they've been on loan, whether or not because they've had a few injuries, or whether or not because they are in the case of Kostas Tsimikas, I'm going to get it right eventually, new signings for the Reds. That is the key thing about that. And if the key thing about the friendlies as well is to see how these players click in with the lads who are already very well established.
Yeah, look, I there's no surprises with the Liverpool squad at the moment, apart from the new lads coming in, about how intense this training period is going to be. I don't think they'll be taking anything for granted. I think I seen a tweet the other day from the account saying nice jog this morning, and Van Dijk replied with one of them emojis that was like a distressed face saying jog. So, it's going to be a short pre-season, but I'm telling you now, they're going to be doing two sessions a day, cycling to and from training, and they're going to be fit lads. They're going to be really ready for this, hitting the ground running. So I think managing Kostas, I'll have a go at a second name at some point. Tsimikas, I think.
Well done. Tsimikas. You've done it well in. Yep.
I'm somewhere there or thereabouts with his name. I think he settling him in will be a big part of this Austria trip. I think there's a video that the club put out again the other day inside training where he's talking to Salah. You know, he's getting to know everyone. Klopp even says, you know, in a little speech he gives, know, it's tough at the start, but hopefully we're all together and help them through getting settled in. And, you know, we've had a few years of Klopp now, so everyone, there's no, as I said before, there's no surprises coming into a pre-season for everyone else. So it's sort of got, we feel like we're on the crest of a wave at the moment. We had the European Cup final of the year, bounced back and won it the year after, won the league season just gone. So at the moment, like the confidence in the players and the staff and what they're doing is absolutely sky high. They've had reminders all over the show that we are doing what is right and we're stepping forward, making good progress. So I think everyone's mentality going into these two games are, well, it's just another part of pre-season. It's got to be done. We've got to, you know, they're not going to be playing, I don't think, 90 minutes from the start, but everyone will be getting good minutes in the legs. We've also got Arsenal, which is a sort of a nice thing to walk into the weekend after this one coming up. So, and then we've got a bit of an international break, which is a pain, but I expect us to be there or thereabouts in terms of fitness from the start, because that's what Liverpool are at the moment.
Mike's talked about the fitness there, Ali. The thing that I always wonder, there's lots of times when you're a football supporter where you think, oh, I'd love to be a fly on the wall and see this, see X, see how they recover from a defeat, see how they pick themselves up. For me, I think the most interesting time, and it's the time that happens shrouded in darkness where we're not meant to be paying that much attention. From a Liverpool point of view under Jurgen Klopp, this is the time I wish I could be the fly on the wall right now. New players coming in, young players emerging, a general sense of team building, a sense of building collective expectations on and off the pitch. I think it must be absolutely fascinating to do a 2-week training camp with this Liverpool squad currently.
That's right. And we know that particularly now, you know, gone are the days of, you know, Alan Hansen getting up and having a bit of a stretch before games. You know, we know that like the level of planning that goes into the pre-season is incredible, because it has to be, because the amount of fitness you have to have to be an elite footballer cannot be gained by running about a bit or, you know, keeping generally fit. So in order to have any sort of holiday or breaks, they have to work out what's the route out of that break from training, such that you reach the optimum point of fitness alongside being able to maintain that level of fitness without injury. And that is like a really careful balance. It's like a really difficult, optimal point to identify. And, you know, we were saying before about how we sort of forgot about injuries until Jordan Henderson got injured, and then it was all like, oh yeah, that stuff happens. I remember seasons gone by where we've been absolutely dogged by injury, particularly in the Gerrard years, where we were so wholly dependent on his fitness. It was really challenging then to manage around the potential of him getting injured and, you know, other people getting injured, that meant that he had to play more than was ideal. And so this period is really, really crucial. I think it's fascinating from a technical point of view how you actually manage into that period, but also from a psychological point of view, it's really fascinating to understand, you know, how the players get themselves in a place for it as well. I mean, the level of anticipation that they must be facing at the moment is huge, especially given what they've been through. I mean, given the psychological drama of the end of last season and then now into this one, it must be really, really challenging. But I bet they know loads of things about, you know, the human body and the human mind and what it can do. It would be absolutely fascinating to know.
They find themselves, Imani, with this one, it becomes a different challenge. Last two seasons, it's been a quest for something that hasn't been realised. And now it's interesting the managers use that language of attack the title. I think they'll have been using that sort of language themselves amongst one another with reference to this training camp and getting ready for this thing that is to come next, because it is different. They are now there to be shot at. They are the team that are targeted at the very top of the pile. They go into the season as champions, and that does change the psychology of it. I suspect the senior players and the manager have got a plan for that.
Yeah, and to be honest with you, if I'm Jurgen Klopp, I'm actually pretty happy that we didn't break the 100 points total, because it would have been really hard to motivate the greatest squad ever to do it again the next year. So he was very much like shoulder shrug, oh well, we've already got the title, we're okay. So I think for us, you know, they really want to win it again for the fans. It's really difficult to win a title in an empty stadium. I mean, Degsy, you know, now he's over at Denner. He got on and said, oh, I went out in my car and did all that kind of stuff. And he was the only one who was crazy enough to do that kind of thing. And maybe that's one of the reasons he's been moved on. Jürgen hates that kind of thing. But yeah, I think there is definitely motivation for us to come and do it again this year. And I think, you know, it's going to be tough. These players have had to be switched on for, it's going to be 24 months of football with 2 weeks off. 24 months. We've got the Olympic Games. We've got the European Championships next year. We're back into a four competition season. We even took the Champions League out of everything now and had it basically played separately from the rest of the season just to fit it in. And it's pretty insane. But I think that because it's going to be so challenging, like these first fixtures are going to be a huge indication like of how we're going to play.
The other thing we do with Marnie as well is we find ourselves in a situation where we talk about them always as the team, the group, whereas even just in this pre-season, different players have got different onuses upon them. Virgil van Dijk does not bounce into pre-season fearing for his place, and I mean that with the greatest respect. He's the best central defender on the planet. Whereas this pre-season and the early games, they're massive for, and the pre-season friendlies, massive for Brewster, massive for Minamino, in a sense massive for Keita. Could be significant for the entire life of Marco Grewe. Which, you know, and I think that that's a difficult thing to remember, that they are all, we like to think of them as a team and they are a collective. There is massive togetherness, but they are also individuals in amongst there as well with different needs and wants.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's like Karius is back in the team again. You know, it's almost like he forgot about him. So we're going to see a lot of faces. I mean, we are the biggest club in the world right now. We are the sexy club still. Everybody wants to come to us. Barcelona's falling apart. I'm sure all this like talk about Genie going to play with his national team manager. Why would you want to go from our dressing room to one where Messi and Gerard Piqué are unhappy? So it's kind of like everybody wants to play for us, but like how do we kind of like move on some people who kind of need to be moved on, get players to grow. It's like, do we loan out Harry Wilson again, or do we let him fight for his place? Like, do we bring in Thiago, and then do we have to, like, you know, move on Shaqiri, or do we send Curtis Jones out on loan, which we don't really want to do. We've already said that we don't want to do. Minamino, this is a huge season for him. Even in the short period of time between, you know, coronavirus happening, Naby Keita came back stronger, fitter. He looked more up for a Premier League style of play, whereas Takumi Minamino, he didn't look like he was quite ready for Premier League football. And Liverpool at a club this level, we can only wait for players to develop so long, especially because he's 25. He's not a young player. So if he's not up for it, then we have to do what we have to do. But overall, we have really nice problems right now. We still only have good problems, and that's exciting for us.
It is exciting for us. The good problems part of this, Ian, it bounces into the friendly games for me a little bit. There's Stuttgart and Salzburg. I'm sure they're quite cleverly chosen sides in the environs of where Liverpool are doing this camp. But one of the things that I think with them is there's a little thing here where for some players it's about reasserting fitness, it's about getting to know your teammates, but we've got to be quite honest. There's a couple there who will be a little bit shop window from Jurgen Klopp. He would never say it to them, I'm sure, but in the back of his mind, there might be some players who end up getting 60 minutes, 70 minutes that we might be quite surprised by, where actually what he's doing is telling a story to the outside world and not to the Liverpool supporters or his Liverpool squad.
Yeah, you would imagine that there might be a possibility that Divock's used in that way, because it feels like whatever's happening, it feels like his time is kind of coming to an end. He didn't get the minutes he would have thought last season. He hasn't pushed on from it. The same could apply to Chamberlain. From, you know, Mel's article this morning, as we're talking about the idea that if we're going to bring Thiago in, it'll be because somebody leaves midfield. Chamberlain could be a person who could possibly be wanting more more starts elsewhere. Then again, he could be somebody who's perfectly happy with where he is and feels that he can actually challenge for a full position. And this could be the season that he really kicks on. Same with Keita. It's an interesting one, because I think one of the advantages of the way last season's gone is this season feels like a continuation. It doesn't feel like there's been a break. It doesn't feel like you've got a set of players that you have to motivate again. You've got a set of players who are still feeling what they were feeling 3-4 weeks ago, and it will move from there. And within that, you've then got the likes of Minamino, who's seen that we've won. You've got the likes of Brewster, who's come back after a good spell on loan, who feel that they can definitely push on and make themselves valuable this time round. I think, again, there's that fascinating psychology of every individual. If you're Harry Wilson, you probably feel the likelihood is that you are going elsewhere. You're probably looking at and going, there's probably not a way through to the first team. but you have got a career based on what you've done already, and this shop window could be great for him again. I've got to be honest, when we were talking friendlies, I knew the friendlies had been arranged, but in my head, they're somewhere a month away, and they're not. That they're here, they're now. So the likes of Gruitch, this is a great chance for him to show either that he has a chance with us or that he can be full-time. It was Schalke, wasn't it? He was at. He can be there full-time. Or Hertha Berlin. I can't even remember where Gruitch was anymore. Hertha Berlin. This could be his chance to show, look, buy me, which then frees up a bit of space, frees up some wages.
The friendlies are interesting, Mike, in that the two sides that Liverpool have actually got relationships with. Salzburg spoke so warmly of Liverpool after they bought Minamino, and we saw the quality they had home and away last season. Stuttgart, where Nat Phillips went on loan, and I do wonder whether or not there's something in the back of Liverpool's minds there, because they play a certain way. Stuttgart, they're very, very interesting from centre-half. People who know this stuff tell me. So they are only a Bundesliga two side, but they find themselves in a position where they've got promoted, of course. They got promoted whilst Nat Phillips was there, so they're going to be playing top flight football this season. I think these have been, it isn't just whoever's down the road and local. I think Liverpool have chosen Stuttgart, they've chosen Salzburg because they want a particular challenge.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen, as you mentioned, the Salzburg, they gave us two really good games, so much so that we went out and signed one of the lads who was really good against us. Stuttgart are probably really, really happy that we've agreed to this, to be honest, because they've gone from a league where they probably they got promoted, so they were winning more than, you know, they probably will expect to this season, and they'll want a tough game going in to prepare what their shape is without the ball. And, you know, I think we'll be able to give that to them, as well as that benefiting us in terms of maybe someone dropping deep, playing, you know, with lots of space in front of defences. So, you know, I'm not sure if they'll be televised, so I don't think we'll get to see much. I haven't paid much attention. I was shocked when I found out we had friendlies, to be honest. I just thought we'd go maybe something behind closed doors, not put out, but it's all out there for us all to know now that we're playing two teams. And I think Klopp's done it in a way in which where we've got a short window, so we'll get as much as we can into both games in terms of what we're going to face this season. And then we've got Arsenal, who, you know, we probably should have beat towards the end of last season. It was two mistakes that you can put them away and file them under rare miracles that Alisson and Van Dijk mistakes don't really ever happen, and they do when we lose. But we should probably get a draw or a win because we're the better team. So I think, you know, then we've got three games before the first game of the season. You want to win, obviously, all of them, but the main thing Klopp will be wanting is, what's the setup? What's the pressing? Are we all back in? Have we got everyone fit? Have we got enough minutes in for the first? I think you'll block the first five games will be a block pretty much till the first UEFA. Is it Nations Leagues again in October?
Yes, it's Nations League September, October, and November. Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, there we are. We'll block them up into five games, three or four when we come back from the first one. And we'll just say we'll get to there and see where we are. But, you know, we've got Leeds, we've got Aston Villa. Apart from Leeds, we know what we're going to get from the other teams, basically. So I think the fact that we've got two friendlies to maybe try something new in that we mightn't have in last season is there. But I think we'll just be using them as a base for fitness and getting ready for the first game, and hopefully, you know, being able to kick on from 3 points on the board.
Absolutely. Excellent stuff. Can't wait to get to watch Liverpool play again this weekend and on Tuesday. You'll get to see those footballers in red run around a little bit and kick it to one another. It is available to watch LFC TV doing that, and I think that's one of the reasons why those games were never going to be played behind closed doors. Thank you very much indeed to Mike Kearney, to Ian Salmon, to Ali McGovern, and to Imani Williams for the weekend of this week. To Dermot, John, and to Dave Lynch as well. Whatever you're doing this weekend, just enjoy yourselves. Have a nice time. I mean, you know, there's a lot of football matches to come. And I'll take no excuses, no sick notes. No one will be allowed off duty. See you later. Sports Social Podcast Network.